Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Today, we did a regular memorial for Reverend Master Jiyu, and the scripture that we recited, this is for the sake of those listening on this, you all know what we recited. The scripture, the immeasurable life of the Tathagata. Now, there's a story associated with that scripture where the Buddha is teaching along those lines. And the people listening to him say that you say that the world is a pure land, but we cannot see it. So what do you mean? And in the story, in the sutra, the Buddha presses his toes into the earth and the world is transformed. Now, what is the meaning of the Buddha pressing his toes into the earth? And how is this connected with River Master Jiyu? And also, how is this connected with the present world situation, to use a contemporary euphemism? I read something recently where somebody in another spiritual tradition said that when people hear about the results of any form of spiritual practice, they expect it to come to them. They expect it to be proved true to them. When in fact, we need to engage with practice and with the Dharma in order for it to be true for ourselves. Oftentimes, people think that greed, hate, and delusion, anger, hatred, harsh speech, are the real. And kindness, generosity, and peacefulness are some sort of illusion preached by people out of touch with the world, such as monks are presumed to be. When in fact, it is the kindness and compassion that is real. But one can become so overwhelmed by the unreal that it becomes hard to see this, and one is inclined to give up. Dogen has a saying that when people think that the results of training and the results of practice are for other people than themselves, that this is the most useless of all useless opinions. When I was 21, I was looking for a Buddhist monastery. I had read about Buddhism. You know, I found it intellectually satisfying. And I was looking for a monastery, and as circumstances developed, found this one in the Whole Earth Catalog. For those of you who are old enough to remember the Whole Earth Catalog, access to tools, actually. And in Newfoundland, which is not a place where one expects to find such things. And I traveled for the first time, you know, in a plane, and for the first time outside of Newfoundland to any substantial degree. Flew into San Francisco and took the bus up, the Greyhound. I had an intellectual engagement with my mind, with the Dharma. It made sense to me. So I was maybe hoping to find some place where I could go and practice it. And I was a very unhappy person. I would say my default mind was total misery. I would say that's quite accurate. I'm not exaggerating. And so what I was seeking, although I wouldn't have articulated it this way, was a little peace. You know, just a little, just a little peace, a little peace for a moment. And I also wanted to make my life have meaning. I don't think I'll go into all the details of being in another country and suffering culture shock in a major way. And then in the middle of it, all this British woman. But I never expected to encounter it authentically until I met Reverend Master. For me, my experience of it was she was somebody who, like the Buddha, pressed their toes into the ground. And the universe appeared different. There's that poem that she wrote years ago that is on the bell down out there. From strange abysmal depths I have climbed forth to view the universe and find it fair and wondrous as the morning star. Now, that aside, how does one actually do this? What is the antidote to external things seeming to lose their center? I'm not quite convinced that they've entirely done so, but ever so often, even I sort of think. But one of the ways of doing this is what Dogen calls the four wisdoms: charity, tenderness, benevolence, and sympathy. That is, to actually, in our actual lives, not in a life of practice separate from our daily lives, not in a life of just in a life of practice when we go to temples or attend retreats or whatever, but rather in our real lives, that is, our lives in front of us. Some of the unhappiest people I have ever met in my life, I would say the most unhappy people I ever met in my life, were people who ostensibly had everything. There was a particular person I met who was immensely successful, well-known, published author, quite clever, nothing lacking, but who came to see me and was this more miserable than a homeless person I've seen in the downtown east side in Vancouver. You could say that the homeless person knew poverty and that this person knew a type of poverty in the midst of plenty. This person had the means to be of benefit to others. Which many people do not. She had the means to do so. But instead, it was all taken up with herself. And she was deeply, crushingly unhappy. So the only thing I could do is, as they call it in Zen, give candy. Okay? You do something that gets the person slightly out of their unhappiness for the moment in the hope that they will have some sort of insight in how to proceed. And I honestly don't know whether that happened. Charity, tenderness, benevolence, and sympathy, as Dogen says, are the means we have of practicing the Bodhisattva way and being of benefit to others. Dogen didn't come up with them. They belong to the beginning of Buddhism. They're called the ways of practicing the Dharma, having to do with other people, other beings. How we present the Dharma to other beings. Once we have some sort of grasp that training and practice and meditation are about us rather than something at a distance or something to calm down the mind briefly or something to make us feel good for the rest of the week, there's a saying that if you do not practice, you simply use up past merit without creating any more. In the really old Buddhist sutras, it's called eating stale food. Anything that lessens our own selfishness is training. Now, it has become customary, particularly, well, almost exclusively, I would say, in the West, to view the main problem as that we do not love ourselves enough. So there's a lot of emphasis on that. But that can become, and is often actually, a form, just simply another form of self-absorption. If we continue to try to prop up a selfishness that actually does not fundamentally exist, then all we are doing is, as the founder of the Pure Land Tradition in Japan said, all we're doing is polishing up our dirt until it gets shiny. And it still remains dirt. It's just nice and shiny dirt. Charity means to, as Dogen says, to make offerings. Now, people often, when they hear this, think of it purely in terms of, I have something which I give to other people. But in fact, as our Master Jiyu constantly pointed out, it actually has to do with generosity of spirit. When one lives in a monastery, this is something which is particularly emphasized, drummed into us, in fact, the difference between the time I do my own stuff and the time I am doing stuff for the community. And monastic life, such a dichotomy or division between those two things, is one of the utter wastes of time that are part of learning in early monastic life. In early monastic life, there are all these things which are utter wastes of time, and one should give them up immediately. One is comparing oneself with others. You know, why has this person got something I don't have? Utter waste of time. Utter waste of time. Might as well drop it. And then the other thing is setting up a false division in the way that I spoke of. To press the toes into the ground is to grasp hold of one's life, not simply at a distance, not simply like a teddy bear, you know, here I am grasping my life, but I'm holding it out there. But rather, which is quite silly, of course, because one's life does not exist separately from oneself. To grasp one's life in the same way as if one was making bread. Of course, people can get machines to pound, knead the bread, but I'm not talking about that. That's the machine engaging with its own life. Or, they say gardening is a reasonable metaphor. Or I spoke of one not very long ago, but I think that was to an individual, how when we were looking, when I was one of the chaplains for Master Jiyu, and one night, the chaplain who usually cleaned out the, what do they call it? Chamber pot? Do people know what a chamber pot is? Piss pot? Those who don't. Wasn't piss in it. And Reverend Scholastica handed it to me. Well, what are you going to do? You know, are you going to say, oh, I don't do that? Couldn't somebody else do it? That's another one of those useless things in monastic life, for that matter. As Dogen talks about when he first went to China, and Dogen was, as they say, a painfully sincere, very intellectual person. Very judgmental of other people's training in China. And so he comes across this old cook who he might have thought that he could teach something to. And the old cook had come down to buy mushrooms. Japanese mushrooms, as it turned out. And so Dogen says, you know, can you stop and talk for a little bit? And the monk was willing to talk for a little bit. And he said, the monk said, well, I have to get back. Tomorrow is the Buddha's birthday, and I'm making the food. And I bought these mushrooms, got these mushrooms for it. And Dogen says, why are you wasting your time cooking? Shouldn't you be practicing koans, you know, sitting, meditating, etc.? And the old monk, the old cook, laughed at him. And he said, you poor foreign person, you don't understand what it's about at all now, do you? And Dogen, and they do this little verse exchange. Dogen says, well, then what is it about? And the old monk said, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And Dogen says, well, elaborate further. And the monk said, nothing is hidden. Now, they were being slightly Japanese or Chinese, but 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 means you start here. Remember Master Ji used to say it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, not 6, 8, 10, 2. You move from one thing to the other, the next thing. And then nothing is hidden means that you don't lack anything to know, to train, to learn how to train. Because the training is done with our body and mind as it is. It isn't done with an idealized body and mind. It isn't done with the idea, if only these circumstances were different. That's another useless thing in monastic life. Utterly useless. You know, like, if only I had better health, then I would be a better trainee. You know, utterly useless. Useless, useless. Put it in the useless, useless pile. Not to throw my uselessness over in your direction. Utterly waste of time. Mind you, it takes a long time to learn this because it's kind of like knocking at a door. I remember when I became a postulant. The postulants got up earlier, about a half an hour, than anybody else, and swept the cloister. And there had been another postulant, but they left. So here I was on the first time, Brum, and sweeping cloister. It was rather cold. And it was very unpleasant because one was immediately faced with nothing but oneself. You know, there was nothing in between. There was nobody there to say there, there. Again, utterly useless, there, there. There was nobody to talk to. There was nothing to do other than do that, particularly for an intellectual type person who was in their mind. And although I would say it was extremely unpleasant, I almost look back on that time with a great deal of nostalgia, just as that time Rerum Scholastica handed me the poo pot. Poo pot, that's what I wanted to say. Because you can't do anything about it other than proceed. Now, oh, I don't know how many years ago it was now, maybe 5 or 6 or 7 years ago, I fell out of the loft up where we're living in Lytton. My leg went down through, people always cringe, but my leg went down through the steps, went over like that, and I broke both bones. And it was extremely painful and all the rest of it. But as I lay there, there was this funny, unexpected sense of liberation because there was nothing I could do about it. You know, I couldn't say, oh, don't worry about me. I'm just going to go lie down in the next room. Or, you know, could you get a Band-Aid? It was broken like that, so the bones were sticking out and both major bones had shattered. All the bones had shattered. So I wouldn't necessarily go through that experience again, of course. But there was something about the freedom of having to address what was in front of me without any means of getting away from it. Okay? I imagine this sounds quite weird, but... and all of these things I've been talking about are related to one another. I had, when I came here for the first time, I had read an enormous amount about Buddhism. Somebody told me I was a walking library. And I had read about the life of the Buddha. And what struck me, I arrived here just as the events in How to Grow a Lotus Blossom were occurring in the monastery. Which means it seemed a bit strange, but I didn't know how it was supposed to be, if you know what I mean. So there was nothing to compare with. It was all different. And Reverend Master, we were moving rocks constantly, if any of you remember those days. We were moving rocks from one place to the other because there were those buildings torn down. There were rocks, piles of them all over the place. And so, as I'm sure many of you who are here for retreats appreciate, we longed for any break from this. Okay? Even evening service. Because I've never been able to sit cross-legged, so I was in pain all the time anyway from it. But we longed for anything. You know what I mean? I think you know what I mean. Probably in your workplaces, too. We longed for anything, like a break, you know, a momentary, anything. And so we were kind of edging towards evening service, you know, midday service, whatever they call it, Zazen rules. Well, that will be soon. That'll be in a half an hour. And you're checking your watch, which is, again, a waste of time, but still, you're checking your watch. You know, that whole idea of, they say, not being in the moment, as it were. Although being in the moment is not much use either because it constantly changes. I mean it. It's, you know, there's that thing of if you're constantly in the moment, but it's shifting. So actually you have to let go of the desire to hang on to anything. But so there was an announcement made that evening service was canceled because we had too much to do. So, you know, then you're working on all acceptance. And if you've ever tried all acceptance when you don't feel very accepting, it is very uncomfortable. And then there was an announcement about half an hour later that Roshi, which is what we called River Master then, wanted to see everybody in the meditation hall. So we all trooped into, it was the library. At that time, you know, this down the other end of the property was in there. So we all trooped in, tired. You know, it's one of the things that many changes in our viewpoint occur when we've exhausted other options. So we went in and sat down, and River Master, who those of you who have met her, I mean, she was a very impressive person. Particularly in the really old days, because I was scared of her. I had just read a biography of the last Empress of China, so I used to call her the Empress Mother in my mind. Not in a rude way. I thought it was pretty accurate. And she had just come back from the Bay Area, so she was straightening everything out, if you've ever seen her do that. In any case, she came in, she sat down, she apologized for canceling evening service. And she said, the I that canceled evening service is not the same I that runs this temple. Well, I was completely blown away. And I don't know quite how to, you know, explain that to you. If it isn't obvious and straightforward. In other words, that there is something other than the selfish self. There is something other than the person who wants to do this, that, or the other. And I remember sitting there thinking, oh my God, I've hit the jackpot. Who would have thought in the woods in California, of all places? California had a bit of a reputation in those days, as I'm sure you're aware. Even way over in Newfoundland, my professor warned me. And not even in San Francisco, but in the woods of all, you know, the woods in Northern California, in an obscure place, I thought I might find a nice monastery. But I had somehow hit on something where it's more than the narrative of training. It's more than talking about it. And then I think it was a few days later, Reverend Master came into the meditation hall for the first time and spoke about the lotus blossom, and, you know, the experience she was having. That was the first time she'd spoken to the laity regarding it. And again, I was immediately filled with doubt immediately afterwards, tell you the truth. I must be crazy. And so I remember when she finished, I ran as fast as I could out of the hall into the cupboard by the side to write down that I knew what I wanted to do before I had a chance to kind of have my doubts, if you know what I mean. And so I wrote it down, my diary. There's a saying, Dogen says, to encounter the wheel of the Dharma with gratitude is as rare as meeting a tiger in the city. I think we're talking about China. I don't think the Japanese encounter tigers in their cities. But for many years, I thought that that phrase meant it is as rare as a tiger to encounter the Dharma. But in fact, the phrase that's important is the with gratitude. Because from a certain perspective, we encounter the Dharma all the time, particularly if we've reached a certain age. Every time we have difficulty getting up from a chair, this is impermanence. This is our life. Whose life is it? Whose bones are those? When we get up from the chair, when we can't get up from the chair, or from bowing, in my particular case, which is why it was delayed a bit, I was feeling a bit faint. This is our encounter with our own lives. The Buddha's teaching on emptiness is often not understood. The Buddha's teaching on emptiness means not only that we have everything that we need to train with, but also that we as an individual possess abundance, a deep well from out of which we can be of benefit to others in all sorts of ways. There is a poem I'm fond of, W.H. Auden, which I noticed a few years ago when certain events occurred in Vancouver, everybody was in the library looking up W.H. Auden's poem written on the outbreak of World War II called September 1939. And one of the phrases he puts in it at the very end is to show an affirming flame. Because he talks about the outbreak of the war, which he had seen coming for some period of time, which many people didn't. And the whole business of the selfishness that had set it in motion, and the pattern that was about to be repeated. He said, mismanagement and grief, we must suffer them all again. And he talks about how that the problem is not, well, the problem is not and what it is. And he says, the error bred in the bone of each woman and each man because, he says, it is people do not want universal love. They want to be loved for themselves alone. And he says, very Buddhist, although he wasn't particularly, he points out that this is actually impossible. And he says, we must love one another or die. And then at the end, he says, ironic points of light where the just exchange their messages. May I, composed like them, of Eros and the dust, show an affirming flame. To show an affirming flame is to turn one's life to this engagement of the pressing of the toes, if I can put it that way, into the world as it is. To practice charity, tenderness, which is kind words, benevolence, and sympathy. Benevolence means to find good ways of helping beings. And not just in beings as an abstraction, which many people do. They help beings. There isn't a problem with sending checks overseas. It's more that if one is going to do something about oneself, one has to engage with the person next to one. You know, not simply, do you understand what I mean? If it's an abstraction, as I think it was Martin Buber who said that too many people experience the pain of others as a short, sharp pain in the heart. And that they think that this is compassion. But he says, compassion is to engage with the other, with all of existence. Sympathy, in those four wisdoms, means to work with others, to engage with others. This, all that I've been talking about, requires courage. But courage is often simply looking clearly at what one needs to do, and then, instead of wandering off into the various distractions, to do it. As we grow older, we experience our limitations, as it were. And sometimes, with many people, there is a drawing within. And I don't mean in a good way. No matter how old one is, one can still engage with the other person next to one. There is a old saying, which I'm very, very fond of, which I'm going to end with. It's from a book, old children's book written in the Victorian era, called The Water Babies. It's quite a peculiar book, but it has very, very interesting and very direct lessons. And one of the things it says is, in order to become a spiritual adult, you have to be willing to do that which you don't want to do, to go where you don't want to go, and to help those that you don't want to help. This also is the essence of training. I personally use a particular mantra. I don't mean I use it effectively necessarily, but my particular one is, what is it that is good to do? And if it is good to do, then I need to get up and do it. However I feel about it. Homage to all the Buddhas in all worlds. Homage to all the Bodhisattvas in all worlds. Homage to the scripture of great wisdom.